So if you were a freshman in Congress, what would you do to investigate Putin, and what would you do about the Castro brothers, which Roosevelt, he had, I know he had a Monroe Doctrine corollary. So what would you do?
Well, I'm not much into conspiracy theories, I guess, but I think overall we need to take, we've had these threats around for a long time, so-called threats, and I think we need to process how we think about foreign countries. We think automatically overseas when something happens, we think that somebody did something to us or somebody could do something to us, and we never really examine our own behavior because there's a history of U.S. actions that may have contributed to, certainly not, I'm not blaming 9/11 on U.S. people, but the United, Osama bin Laden's main gripe with the United States is that we were occupying Saudi Arabia and other Muslim lands with non-Muslim forces. This is a problem throughout the world. It's the problem in Palestine. It's the problem in Chechnya. It's the problem in, when the Soviets were in Afghanistan. And so we need to examine ourselves before we examine other countries. And I think we would find that the situations are much more complex than our politicians tell us. And so I don't think we should look for imaginary threats overseas, and I don't think we should magnify the threats that we see. We're a very intrinsically secure country. We have two huge moats, and we have weak and friendly neighbors. And since 1945, we have the biggest atomic arsenal ever assembled. And there's nobody that's going to attack us conventionally. The only thing we have to fear is terrorism. Well, we're ginning a lot of this stuff up by stirring the hornet's nest, so we're creating our own threat there. So I don't think we should go trooping around like Don Quixote. And I think a lot of this this Iraq, well, in the case of Iraq, what if Saddam, nobody ever asked this question in the debate for the war, what if Saddam Hussein had a nuclear weapon? Would that necessarily be a threat to the United States? Well, of course, this is a threat to the United States. But North Korea now has several nuclear weapons, and we haven't invaded that country. So, and Iran is close. Are we going to invade them? Other countries we've deterred in the past. We deterred Mao when he had a nuclear weapon, and he actually indirectly threatened to nuke the United States. I think he was worse than probably the Iranians, the North Koreans. He was very radical when he first took over. And so we can't get involved in imaginary threats or magnifying threats, because this is really what drives big government. And I think conservatives really need to realize that the warfare state preceded the welfare state. And, there's no secret that LBJ, Nixon, Reagan, and George Bush are the biggest spending presidents that we've had. LBJ and Nixon had a long war, Vietnam, and Bush has got the long war on terror, and Reagan increased defense spending because he imagined that the Soviet threat was somehow increasing when it was actually decreasing. So I don't think we should get involved in conspiracy theories or that sort of thing.
I have two questions for the panel, for whoever wants to answer. We have been told that the intelligence justifying the attack on Iraq was invented. But what is very unusually told the public by our press is that we got this intelligence. The men of science working for Saddam Hussein wanted to get his favors. So they exaggerated what they were having, and they were telling him that they were about to get the atomic bomb and other weapons of mass destruction. And that's the intelligence we gathered. But what we were not able to see is that the scientists in Iraq were deceiving Saddam Hussein. Now, the second question is this. In Afghanistan, ladies, women were nothing. They were not even able to study. Now they are massively going to education, massively, in Iran, in Afghanistan. And there is, under the circumstances, a kind of democracy in Afghanistan. And in Iraq, we have hundreds, if not thousands, of newspapers, radio stations, free press, absolutely. And we have been trying to reconcile, to put together the Shiites and the Sunnis. Can we understand that as progress? Those are my two questions. Thank you.
Who wants to take that? Ron, do you want to take that?
Well, I can try to address that, but on... Is this on?
Yeah, it's on.
Okay.
It's
on. Yeah. On the issue of how Saddam Hussein was deceived, I think it relates back to something that Ivan just got done saying. What if we knew they did have a weapon? Their deception is their problem. But I had to decide a vote on this, and that some people come up to me and they said, "Boy, you were pretty smart in not believing our government and all this propaganda that we heard." Well, I didn't believe it. I didn't think they had a weapon, but that wasn't the reason I voted against it. It was the fact that Saddam Hussein was not a threat. He didn't have an army. He didn't have an air force. He didn't have a navy. And if he had a single little bomb, it still wasn't a threat. So to me, it was almost irrelevant. I generally can't say that, but that is the truth, because they weren't a direct threat to us. And what was the second part, just briefly?
The second question is, the achievements we got in Afghanistan, for example.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And the achievements in Iraq, hundreds, if not thousands, of newspapers, radio stations, and...
Yeah, well, I have a hard time looking at anything positive coming out of Afghanistan or Iraq, yeah. Because what I was thinking about when you were mentioning that, but at what cost? And I've seen some Afghan women interviewed on this, and they're not nearly... as hysterical about what they used to have compared to what they have now. But it's a tremendous cost. First, we shouldn't do it. It's none of our business. Second, we didn't have the money. And it cost a lot of money, and it cost a lot of lives. And besides, these wars are just beginning. I mean, we're in the midst of them. We're going to be brought to our knees. Osama bin Laden is delighted with us there. You know, there was talk about, no terrorist attacks since 9/11. Well, I think there's been plenty of attacks against us. And Obama made the statement, bin Laden made the statement that, you know, that you will be now on our sand and we'll be over there. We're right in their face. I mean, there's less of an incentive to come over here because they're there and they're undermining us and they wanted to financially bring us our ruin. So even if you can find a little bit here, you might say, well, maybe if we had done nothing, maybe if we had never interfered, there would have been a coup. Saddam Hussein had been killed, and maybe the conditions would be 10 times better. So if you can come up with a couple token little improvements, that to me does not even make me think for the slightest justification for our interventions.
Yeah, I just wanted to, that reminded me of something, this idea that we've made progress in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I would compare it to the South during Reconstruction. There's a general, General Bunting, who wrote a book, I know the guy, and he wrote a book on Grant, so he's an expert on Reconstruction, and he compares the Northern military occupation of the South to the Vietnam War. And he basically says, well, the North won the war and the South won the peace. So what happened was after the Civil War, they went down there with armies and they made the South even madder than they were of having lost the war and having undergone Sherman's scorched earth tactics, which were really war crimes and that sort of thing. But what happened was as long as the Union forces were there, there was progress. But when the Union forces left... And of course, the North got tired. There was a recession, a panic of 1873, which is what they called deep recessions back then. And of course, nobody in the North, everybody got tired of the Reconstruction. It's just like Vietnam. The U.S. went in, we do what we do, and then we got tired and we went home. Well, the North, there was no stomach in the North for continuing this. And of course, what happened was, and there's a new book out that details this, it's called The Re-Enslavement of Blacks After the Civil War. because they had black codes. They forced the former slaves to work on the same ground for a pittance. They arrested African Americans, and they fined them heavily, and then they made them work off the fine. And then, of course, we had the Jim Crow laws. So you can say, really, that the Civil War probably didn't end, or the Reconstruction and the second-class citizens of blacks certainly didn't end until the 1960s. So the same thing is true in Afghanistan and Iraq. You're going to see what looks like progress, but we're holding our finger in the dike, and as soon as we pull the finger out, all that progress is going to evaporate, probably, and we're going to go back to if it's anything like Somalia, U.S. meddling has increased the radicalism in the Islamist community. So Somalia, when the Ethiopians leave, is probably going to descend into worse nightmare because the U.S. has been meddling in there. And I think you have to watch it in these countries that you may get something worse than you have. The progress is very illusory in many of these places.
Yes, this is for Dr. Eland. I believe that you said that your number one rated president was John Tyler, although he was never really elected, I believe. But I think Grover Cleveland was in your top five, maybe?
He's number two.
He's number two, okay. And he was elected twice in 8 years. Today, where we see President-elect Obama being compared to FDR and Abraham Lincoln, what do you think that our next president could learn from a Grover Cleveland? What makes him being ranked number two in your
list? That's a good question. I mean, Grover Cleveland may have been our most honest president, but that's not why I rated him number two, because personal honesty is good, but I stuck to policy. And Grover Cleveland believed in limited government. And the Democratic Party, up until Woodrow Wilson, believed in small government. And he was a true Democrat in that sense. He made some mistakes. He wasn't perfect. But I think he returned us to the gold standard. Tight monetary policy. He was very fiscally conservative. He believed he would get requests to get behind a legislative bill. And he said, I didn't come here to legislate. And there were some very important things, like related to the currency, whether we should go use silver coins, which actually increased the monetary supply, versus just sticking with the gold. And he was very passionate about that, but he refused, as a larger principle, to get involved in legislation. Now, how many presidents, how long has it been since we saw that? I mean, now the president is expected to present a budget, is expected to present legislation, and actively lobby for it to get it passed. But he believed that the president should do exactly what the Constitution and have a limited role. And he was the last of a dying breed, because the next president was William McKinley, and that started William McKinley was a very important president, and you hear almost nothing about him, but if you go down to the Potbelly sandwich store, they have a big picture of him, but I don't think it's because they admire him, it's because they're trying to get the turn of the century flair. But that's the only picture I've ever seen of William McKinley. But he's a very important president, because Grover Cleveland was the last of the what I would say, restrained presidents. Now, even Harding and Coolidge were restrained, but they never went back to the Grover Cleveland model. And so, and Harding and Coolidge, in my view, were pretty good presidents, but Cleveland stuck with the limited executive. He believed in a limited federal government, and he believed in tight money policy.
You might add one thing to that, Ivan. He also was an anti-imperialist.
Right, right, the Hawaii, yeah. He refused to annex Hawaii because there was a U.S.-sponsored a coup there, and he realized that the Hawaiians didn't really want to be part of the United States at that time. And so he declined to... Well, Benjamin Harrison had already submitted the treaty, and he withdrew it when he came in.
It's commonplace in Congress to have pictures on your walls when you're meeting with and shaking hands with the presidents that they have met. I have a picture of only one president in my office. It happens to be Grover Cleveland. And underneath it said, what is it worth if you get elected or reelected if you don't stand for anything?
There's a question.
comment about Reconstruction and a question for Dr. For Representative Paul. About Reconstruction, I think it's vastly overstated the military aspect of Reconstruction. Less than 2 years after Appomattox, the entire U.S. Army was less than 40,000 men, and most of that was in the West within 2 years of Appomattox. For Dr. Representative Paul, a question. Given your opposition to the Fed as unconstitutional, what do you think of the founding fathers, or many of them, having set up the Bank of the United States, which was involved in commercial banking, even more bigger than the Fed, and was written and was set up by Alexander Hamilton and signed into law by George Washington? So how could the Fed then be
unconstitutional? I would have been on Jefferson's side.
Sure.
Because he objected to it. And
He didn't write the Constitution. He wasn't involved in writing the Constitution. George Washington.
Yeah, but I mean, that's my position that, you're arguing the case that they wrote the Constitution and they believe they could have it. Some of the founding fathers were good at, in the theoretical sense, and when they became president, I mean, Jefferson did great thinking and theoretical thinking, but he wasn't high on the list, you know, in Ivan's rating. So they go about and do different things. But no, I think you have to believe in Article 1, Section 8. If it's not there, you can't do it. And I think the courts certainly heard us on that. You know, McCulloch versus Maryland, you know, set the stage for all of this. And these implied powers, oh, yeah, you know, it's implied. And necessary and proper, I mean, that drives me nuts. Well, you can write a law anything that's necessary and proper. Not for the authorities that are explicitly given to the Congress, but they still use this. They have a rule at House that every time you write something, you're supposed to write down what part of the Constitution you got this authority. And they go, oh, the necessary and proper. This is necessary that we do A, B, and C. And it has no relationship whatsoever to the explicit powers granted. But they immediately go off on a tangent, I think, and that's why you get these mixed positions.
Just as a follow-up to what Ron was just saying, getting back to Thomas Jefferson, here's the main author of the Declaration of Independence and many other writings that deal with liberty, and yet, as Ivan discusses in his book, he shows that when Jefferson was in office, he did a whole number of things which were completely contrary to the principles he discussed. One of the exceptions was that he did abolish the first U.S. bank.
That's right.
So that was in keeping with Jefferson's, I think Ron would agree, view that the Constitution didn't authorize that. So question in the back.
R.J. Smith, National Center for Public Policy Research. I'm a private property rights advocate, and I'd like to thank Dr. Paul for bringing up the issue of wetlands and property rights, whereby Congressman Oberstar and Senator Feingold are trying to take the Clean Water Act, which prohibited pollution of navigable waters, which means a boat can go up and down it, to regulating everybody's land in the United States because rainwater might carry something on your land off into a creek, which would flow into a little river, go into a bigger river, and eventually end up into a navigable water. And when it comes to private property rights, I'd like to state that I think that George W. Bush was the second worst president in the United States, second only to Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt nationalized 2/3 of all the land in the western 13 states west of the 100th meridian and turned them over to the federal government. The fortunate thing was nobody lived on those lands, but it did lock up all those resources for the federal government. Now, what George W. Bush has done and his henchmen in the Department of Interior is to come up with a lot of scams with nice sounding names like perpetual conservation easements and cooperative conservation programs, which distinguish the line between private ownership and government ownership. Thank you.
Okay. The gentleman right here in front.
Yep. Okay. My question is for Richard Schenkman. During the post-convention campaign, illegal immigration was scarcely discussed. To a large part, thanks to the connivance of the debate moderators. And my question is this. In view of the meltdown and what have you, do you think that illegal immigration will be reemerge as a major issue? And if so, how soon?
Well, that's interesting. Some people are arguing that the immigration problem will almost take care of itself now because there aren't going to be that many Mexicans who are eager to come to the United States and stand on the unemployment lines or stand around and be unemployed just like everybody else. So I know that already they're noticing a tremendous drop in the traffic coming across the border, both legal and illegal. So it may just be a problem that doesn't materialize until we have prosperous times again, and then we'll have to revisit it.
One more question about the gentleman right here.
This is for Congressman Ron Paul. Who in the Congress are you going to be able to work most closely with to help solve our problems regarding the economy and our foreign policy?
I think I understood the question. Who else in the Congress can I work with on solving our problems?
Yes.
Well, in some ways it's everybody and nobody. Because there's nobody that fully has accepted the constitutional libertarian principle of personal liberty, that is my interpretation. So there are disagreements, but I work very closely with some very, very left-wing Democrats and progressives, and some of them are very, very principled on civil liberties and on the war issue, and some of the conservatives. Jeff Flake probably votes with me the most on the economic issues, but probably not on the civil liberties. But I notice, even on civil liberties, he's sort of shifting a little bit. So, and Walter Jones is a conservative, and he sort of has shifted gear. He voted for the war, but now he is adamantly opposed to this war. So there's a lot of shifting. And I just try to work with anybody who will pay any attention, and looking forward to a few new ones coming in. But there's no one little group. Although I do have a group called the Liberty Caucus, and we bring together, and there might be 10 or 12, and there are some liberal moderate Republicans. Most of the time they're Republicans. Sometimes Democrats show up, and then there's mostly conservatives. But they just come together on different issues. And even this week I had, we had somebody testifying from SEC dealing with the Madoff scandal. And the scream now is for more regulation. Like we had the SEC, in the Depression, and it didn't solve the problem. We had Enron, and so we had Sarbanes-Oxley, and that didn't solve the problem. Now we have another Madoff scandal. Now we're going to have more regulations. And I tried to make this point, really making points to the far left. Why is it that you understand that we don't want to regulate personal behavior and teach people how to live and take care of their lives, and we don't get involved in religious matters, and a lot of bad things happen from religion and philosophical reasons. We allow that to occur in the press. What do we do with the press? We don't have prior restraint, and just think. In the paper they libel us and slander us and they do all these kind of things. But all of a sudden they throw their hands up and they say every single economic transaction has to be regulated, trying to bring that together. And, that I couldn't even have made that argument 10 or 15 years ago. They probably would have shut me down quicker. But now they're paying a little bit more attention. So there is no 3 or 4 or 5 that's exactly. But I really, in a very serious way, believe that the freedom philosophy is adaptable to everybody across the spectrum. It's just that I'd like to get them more to think it's worthwhile to be consistent. The Constitution is far from perfect, but I believe in the rule of law, and we ought to do our best to follow. If we don't like it, we should change it. And fortunately, I do believe that the Constitution is fairly libertarian and freedom-loving, and if we would just interpret it that way. And I'm reassured. They all took their oath yesterday, so we're off and running.
Rick, yes?
Yeah, that small Liberty Caucus of yours of 10 or 12 people, your problem is your timing. A century ago, you would have had a lot more members in that Liberty Caucus, but something happened, and that was the 1930s and the Great Depression, and liberty was redefined. Up until then, liberty was defined in terms of natural liberty. Beginning in the 1930s, it began being defined as what we now call, political scientists call, programmatic liberty. In other words, programs to help people live better lives, and that's the welfare and Social Security and all those other programs we associate with the New Deal. And one thing to keep in mind is that it was the Great Depression which changed that definition of liberty in American culture, and we are now on the edge of another possible depression. So if anything, the pressure is going to be to make your caucus even smaller, because the worst times, the worst things get, the more people are going to demand government action.
Well, in many ways, I work with trying to be optimistic about it. And
trying to just throw a wet blanket on you.
Yes, in a way, though, you used fancier terms, but I usually talk about a while back. I don't always say the Depression, but somewhere along the way, 100 years ago or so, we chopped freedom into two pieces, economic liberty and personal liberty. And, of course, my goal is to put it all back together. Believe me, I talk a whole lot about that, and the college kids understand this. They understand personal liberty and economic issues, liberty. And when I talk to them, I tell them, look, if you want your freedom and you mess up, don't come crawling to the government to bail us out or take care of you. The responsibility is on you. And they do understand that things aren't going quite well, and they know they can't depend on the government anymore. The government they've given up on, Social Security is not going to be there for the college kids, and they know that. But I think we're talking about the same thing. Thank you.
Well, one thing I might just add also about this whole issue of the recession and the huge bailouts and the Fed's credit expansions and so on and so forth, the zeitgeist, the reigning view of an age has been that government is the solution to almost everything. But the traditional Keynesian view of managing an economy through government spending and deficits and all the rest of it is one that a growing number of economists challenge. They challenge the orthodox view that the New Deal ended the Great Depression. The view among many of these scholars is that these New Deal measures prolonged and deepened the Great Depression, and it was the little guy who paid for it. And that's the issue that needs to come through, is that people have to realize that political power is done in the name of interest groups for their own benefit. And they seek to sort of spin a fog to delude people into believing that it's in their interest. So I want to thank our three speakers. If you join me in a round of applause. Copies of Ivan's book are available, and I'm sure he'd be happy to autograph copies. I want to thank again Congressman Paul. He has to bolt. But thank you all for joining with us, and we hope that you'll join with us at our next event. Good night.
Stay in touch now.